It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk about credit card debt, how much people in Wisconsin are carrying, and how we can manage it. First, no business development deal has loomed quite as large in recent memory as Wisconsin's 2017 agreement with Taiwan-based electronics manufacturer Foxconn. It was seen at the time as a big win for now former Governor Scott Walker. It was referred to by President Trump as the eighth wonder of the world. When Foxconn in Wisconsin first entered the deal, the company said it would invest roughly $10 billion to build an LCD screen factory in Mount Pleasant. In return, it would receive tax breaks, big ones, and other incentives from the state. Originally, it was estimated that the factory would create roughly 13,000 jobs. Since then, the proposed facility has gone through a number of changes, and a new report finds that the deal might not ultimately yield the return on investment for the state as previously estimated, even if it's renegotiated. Our next guest is the author of that report and joins us now to talk about it. Tim Bartik is a senior economist for the nonpartisan W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us how you came to write this report? Who is asking for this, Tim?
Well, the Department of, I do a lot of research on state and local economic development, and everyone involved in that nationwide has been interested in Foxconn because it was so outside normal parameters. And the State Department Administration asked that I look at what might be the implications of a new contract, what would happen under various scenarios of how a new contract might be applied to a much smaller Foxconn project, and also a radically different project. It's not going to be making the same things that was originally planned.
Before we dig into that, talk about how this Foxconn deal was out of the usual parameters of this state-supported industrial development.
Well, under the original scenario with 13,000 jobs, essentially, if you look at how much is paid over time and discount it back to today's dollars, you were paying over $170,000 per job. Now, the typical incentive deal in the U.S. is about $24,000 per job, $170,000 versus $24,000. So we're talking about over seven times the usual deal. Even the Amazon New York deal was around $40,000 per job. So that aroused some controversy. And here, Foxconn's four times as great. So, a lot of people observing state economic development were very concerned when the Foxconn deal came out because the concern was this is going to lead to an escalation of the state incentive wars, and it may be a problem for the nation as a whole if every state imitated what Wisconsin did with Foxconn.
Have we seen that happen, or is this standing out as a unique blip on the public subsidy radar?
I think it's up in the air what's going to happen. I mean, you saw some really high incentive offers to Amazon. I mean, New York, they actually were much higher. I mean, Newark offered more than New York, and Maryland offered more than Northern Virginia, which succeeded in getting Amazon. So there were some incredibly large deals offered for Amazon. On the other hand, there's also been a backlash, and actually I think it's today that Missouri and Kansas are signing some sort of truce to the war. They've been fighting over firms going back and forth between Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas for years, and they're trying to somehow ease back this competition. So, I think they're both political forces are at work. They're both some states wanting to get more aggressive, and then other people saying, let's calm this competition down.
Based on what we initially saw as the proposal, 13,000 jobs, what has changed today, as far as we know it, as to what Foxconn is actually going to build?
Well, I don't have any inside information, except that the media reports are all saying we might be talking about 1,500 jobs or 1,800 jobs. So it would be much smaller project. It would not be this big technically advanced, very advanced flat screen TV manufacturing, state of the art. It would be much not as advanced. It would be more of a research facility. It'd be more roboticized, more capital intensive. So it looks like a very different, much smaller project. Now, in some sense, you could say it's not going to cost as much then. But the question I was trying to look at was, what if you applied the same credit rates, investment tax credit rates and job creation tax credit rates of the original deal to this much smaller deal? And the answer is actually you could get even greater cost, as much as $290,000 per job And why did the cost go up? Well, it's largely because it looks as if the new project will be what economists call more capital intensive, but what you could simply say, it's going to have more robots per worker.
Talking to Tim Bartik from the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research about a report he did on Foxconn's deal with Wisconsin and its possible future. Tim, people talk a lot about, a lot of this money is conditioned on Foxconn actually creating X number of jobs, and they have to hit these different benchmarks. Are there fixed costs, though, that the state already has paid, is paying, will pay as part of this deal to develop the area that we're not going to get back?
Well, that's the real question. I mean, you can run scenarios, you can run a million scenarios of what might happen under different things under the original contract. I mean, the reality is the local governments there put in a lot of money in the infrastructure, I think close to $1 billion, maybe more than that. And in theory, that's supposed to be reimbursed by property taxes Foxconn's supposed to pay. The state's on the hook if Foxconn doesn't pay, so the state's guaranteed some of that. There's also the whole issue of that even if, let's say under some scenarios, Foxconn creates 1,500 jobs, and let's say the state later on claws back some of the incentives. I mean, essentially what it amounts to is giving a no-interest loan to Foxconn of $116,000 per job that you then try to recover in inflation in dollars years later that are not worth as much because it's many years later that you're not adjusting for inflation and the clawbacks and everything else. So essentially, there still would be a subsidy. So under a best-case scenario, I suppose you could say the best-case scenario for Wisconsin residents for Foxconn would be if somehow it only created 1,500 jobs, you paid it some money, the money was later clawed back, and somehow Foxconn still kept the jobs there. You could also run scenarios where the whole plant closes down, in which case we would have made a no-interest loan. Wisconsin residents would have made a no-interest loan to Foxconn and gotten nothing for it in the long term. I mean, the reality is, look, jobs are valuable. I mean, they increase employment to population ratios. They bring in some tax revenue. So no one's denying that job creation has value. The question is it worth $170,000 per job, or is it worth $290,000 per job? And my answer is no, it probably isn't. That if you look at the benefits from this and compare them with the cost, and not just the cost of the incentives, but the fact that the incentives mean that there's something else the state budget is not doing that it otherwise would be doing. Either you're raising household taxes, you're raising other business taxes, or you're cutting spending on something, roads, you're cutting spending on public schools, universities, something. There is a cost to this, and I think under most scenarios, if you pay $200,000 per job, it's highly unlikely that the benefits for Wisconsin residents will exceed the cost.
As you mentioned, you, Tim, looked at scenarios where the deal is renegotiated, where we look at the new reality of what Foxconn might do, reach a new agreement between the state and Foxconn. The governor or the administration has indicated they might be interested in doing that. What would be the advantage of going back to the drawing board on this?
Well, I think the advantage is it's a totally new project. I mean, the original project is not really what seems to be happening. So I think the advantage is you could go back to the drawing board, and I think you could up front negotiate a deal that might make more sense for Wisconsin residents that would have lower cost per job. I mean, as I said, jobs are valuable. They provide benefits for Wisconsin residents. I think that should be the bottom line for Wisconsin policymakers. What's best for Wisconsin residents if we balance the benefits versus the cost? And if you're paying, $20,000 per job or $30,000 per job, there is a good chance that when you're creating manufacturing jobs, that could pay off. There could be enough effects on employment population ratios and earnings rates and wage rates that it could pay off for state residents. If, on the other hand, you're paying $200,000 per job, that's much less likely scenario. So, I think that it would be wise for the state to try to negotiate a lower cost per job deal with Foxconn.
Part of the hope when this thing was first announced was that it was going to create this gravitational force that was going to create more jobs than Foxconn itself. It was going to make Wisconsin and southeastern Wisconsin a hub of technological development and production. The supply chain was going to maybe create even more jobs. With the latest plans we're seeing from Foxconn. Do you see that as a likely outcome?
Well, I actually included that in my analysis. I included, you know, what economists call the multiplier effect, and I included the multipliers that the various consulting firms that the state and Foxconn use, which said called for a multiplier somewhere between 2 and 3. That is, a multiplier between 2 and 3 means that every one job at Foxconn, there are 1 or 2 other jobs in Wisconsin will be created. So when you say a multiplier is 2, it means 1 Foxconn job, 1 additional job. And, you know, that's actually pretty typical for manufacturing plants like Foxconn. I mean, you know, you can always speculate there'll be some magical technological spillovers and they're going to, you know, there's not a huge amount of evidence that in this case that that will occur when people have looked at this. Yeah, high-tech firms have a little bit higher multiplier. It's not that much higher. You know, it tends to be higher in Silicon Valley, places like Silicon Valley, or for that matter, Madison, than it might be in southeast Wisconsin. You know, so I think assuming a magic multiplier for which there's not a huge basis is unwise. On the other hand, a multiplier somewhere between 2 and 3 is not crazy. I incorporated that in my analysis. Even when you do that, it's unlikely that if you pay $200,000 per job that you're going to get enough in benefits for state residents to justify that cost.
Talking to Tim Bartik right now, senior economist for the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He recently wrote a report looking at Wisconsin's deal with Foxconn, how it could be renegotiated, and how plans have changed over the last couple of years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his report? What would you like to see happen with the Foxconn deal? What is your best case hope for it? If you live in the Mount Pleasant area, what impact do you think the plant is going to have on your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about Wisconsin's deal with Foxconn and a new report that says it might be more costly for Wisconsin as plans have shifted and a possible renegotiation could be in the works. Tim Bartik is with us, senior economist for the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research and the author of that report. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should the state and Foxconn renegotiate? What should the state try to get out of it? Do you still have high hopes for what Foxconn could mean for Wisconsin's economy, for its job outlook? Or do you have fears about what's going to come out of all this? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tim, before we go to our callers, we talked about Wisconsin's possible incentives for wanting to renegotiate with Foxconn. Why would Foxconn want to? What would they want to see change in a deal? Do they have any reason to come back to the table at this point?
Well, there are a whole range of scenarios. Under some scenarios, Foxconn would end up, you know, under the original contract, getting over, you know, getting $170,000 or more per job. Under other scenarios, there would be these clawbacks. And so, you know, I potentially think there could be some political. I think they might rather have a more modest amount of money with some certainty rather than some big political fight over clawbacks. So I think there are some reasons why Foxconn might say, well, look, you know, we're going to have trouble meeting these job targets. Maybe we can negotiate a more modest deal. We can get less money per job, but not deal with the political consequences of having large clawbacks and fights over that.
Let's go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Superior. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've traveled a lot through central Kansas and watched different municipalities battle tooth and nail to get a trash-to-steam plant or a low-level radioactive trash dump. And the question is, why can't we just outlaw incentives like this entirely and have municipalities and states compete for business based on infrastructure, based on the education and training of their population, transportation modes, and quality of life? So we have to stop giving away these so-called tax breaks and do something that actually benefits everyone.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tim, Tom saying end the subsidy wars among American states and cities.
Well, you would have to be willing to have the federal government step in and restrict it. you know, the European Union, which has member states like France and Germany, restricts this much more than the United States restricts what states do. So in the European Union, they have rules that a lot of what we do in incentives in the U.S. would be considered illegal export subsidies if France or Germany tried to do it. What they do is say that unless you're in a distressed region, these things are severely restricted. So Paris and Berlin, since they're doing pretty well, cannot offer any incentives. In economically distressed regions, these things are capped as a percentage of wages or as a percentage of the investment. And even there, it probably wouldn't be as great as what some state offers are. It certainly wouldn't be as great as the Foxconn offers. So, but in order to do that, you'd have to be willing to have the federal government come in, set up some rules for what these incentives could be, and it would involve federal involvement in state decisions about how they structure their business tax system. I think it would arouse considerable political controversy.
You mentioned earlier, and I just seen the headline and didn't get a chance to dig into it, this truce apparently between Missouri and Kansas. Apparently they've been having dueling subsidies, trying to lure businesses back and forth across the border, as we've seen Wisconsin try to do in some cases against Illinois. Do you see this as a case where states thought, okay, hey, we're kind of both losing in this battle?
Well, yeah, and hopefully this will spread. But on the other hand, I, to be honest with you, I'm a little skeptical that without federal intervention this will work, because there have been attempts to do this before. There have been, going back, I've been working in this field in the 1980s, since the 1980s, and there have been, there were attempts in the 1980s and in the 1990s to have various truces. I think there was one between New England governors at some period to try to have a truce. And the trouble is, since states are sovereign, you know, if Kansas and Missouri reach this deal, either state can drop out of it at any time. So if a new governor or a new legislature comes in and decides, well, we want to have this incentive program, we're going to go ahead, there's not much you can do. In order to really have this to be enforceable, you have to have some outside power enforce it, like the federal government.
Talking to Tim Bardick from the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He has a new report out on Wisconsin's deal with Foxconn, what could happen under possible renegotiations between the two parties there. Back to your calls now. Joe is with us in Mount Pleasant. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I think that in Mount Pleasant, they certainly made the wrong decision taking a couple square miles of prime farmland and converting into this factory. It's going to be gone forever. Plenty of brownfields they could have certainly done this, but I understand the business point of having everything under one roof. But that being said, this huge complex, the infrastructure is not there, transportation, housing, and so forth to address this. There's a train line going by there, but there's no way to get to O'Hare from that particular train line. Finally, the village board in Mount Pleasant, I think they got bamboozled by Scott Walker. They bit off more than they could chew, and I think they've just been overwhelmed by the Foxconn issues, and they can't really address the other dog catcher issues that have to be addressed in Mount Pleasant, because they've got this millstone now around their neck for the rest of their lives in Mount Pleasant, and the residents are going to suffer from it. Probably not a good place to live. So I'll take my answer off the air, but I really wish they would have looked at brownfields and try to redevelop that versus taking prime farmland. Thank you.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Joe worried that Mount Pleasant local government was bamboozled by the governor and, I guess, by Foxconn, Tim.
Well, I guess I don't. I mean, it's. I imagine it's pretty difficult for a local government when the state's really pushing for a deal to say no. I mean, local governments are creatures of the state. Ultimately, their powers are constrained by the state. I believe my understanding is that the state basically guaranteed certain debts for the various infrastructure investments that the local governments made. So maybe they felt, gee, this will potentially provide benefits for our residents, and the state has promised that we'll be held harmless if things don't work out. Now, you know, you hope that the project works out at least in some form. I mean, given that the local government has made all these investments and the state has backed them up, although Foxconn is also supposed to make some payments, you would kind of like the project to at least somewhat work out and go forward, even if at a much smaller scale, now that the decision's been done. I mean, the caller also raised the issue of whether or not it would have been better to put it somewhere else. I don't know if that was on the table, whether or not there was any attempt to talk about brownfield locations in the state.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Jan on Facebook who writes, what about the fuzzy deal with UW-Madison that would let Foxconn exploit UW researchers and the loss of valuable intellectual property? I think supporters of the deal say, hey, Foxconn's going to have these have the support for various UW systems schools and have this public-private partnership there. What do you think about, is that a possible side benefit of the project?
Well, I actually don't know too many details about the deal with UW, what's in it, and whether that actually is going forward. I read one recent article, I think, that said that they hadn't heard about that lately and it wasn't clear what was going on with it. I think you always need to look at the details on deals like that. It could very well be a good thing for the state and the university. If there are a lot of attempts around the country to have university business partnerships, sometimes they're quite fruitful, other times they're not so fruitful. So certainly, look at Silicon Valley that originally came out of Stanford Business Park and Research Triangle area, all the things, Route 128, Boston area. So certainly we don't want to have no university business partnerships. On the other hand, we always need to look at the details of how they're negotiated.
In our last minute, you mentioned, Tim, that there are a lot of possible outcomes here. What are some of the next things you're watching for to get an idea of what's going to happen here?
Well, what I want to see is what actually is the negotiation over the next couple of months. I mean, I believe that there will be some kind of attempt to renegotiate this on both Foxconn and Wisconsin's part. I believe that's in the best interest of both Wisconsin residents and probably Foxconn. That will eliminate some uncertainty on both sides about what the costs are, and hopefully it will negotiate the deal down to a more manageable level. And hopefully it'll be a level at which Wisconsin residents can feel that they're not, you don't want to pay so much money for Foxconn that it inhibits your ability to pay for schools and infrastructure and other things that Wisconsin residents need. That's the bottom line.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tim Bardick, senior economist for the nonpartisan W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He joins us today to talk about a recent report he wrote about Wisconsin's deal with Foxconn. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a personal finance expert about how to deal with ongoing credit card debt. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration is planning to make major changes to the Endangered Species Act. We'll look at what would change and reactions to the plan. First, Americans are carrying a lot of credit card debt. The Federal Reserve says as a country, we owe more than $1 trillion on our cards. Here in Wisconsin, we're holding on to some of the lowest credit card debt in the country, according to a state-by-state study published by chamberofcommerce.org. Still a decent amount, though, just over $6,700 per person. So what are the best ways to manage that kind of credit card debt? Peggy Olive is a financial capability specialist with the UW School of Human Ecology's Center for Financial Security and the UW-Madison Division of Extension. Peggy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob, and for focusing our attention on credit.
Yeah, we had this number from the Chamber of Commerce, about $6,700 per person in Wisconsin. That's an average, though. I imagine that could be zero for some people and lots more than that for others. What do we know about how our credit card debt shapes up here in the state?
You're absolutely right that, it's a round number, but it's not going to apply to everyone. So we know half of all people who have a credit card to pay off that entire balance every month. So even if it is about $6,000, it's going to be paid off. But then the other half of individuals, between those, maybe a quarter would carry a balance a few months out of the year, and then a quarter report that they regularly carry a balance. So, definitely there's different ways people handle that credit card debt.
Talk about that last quarter you just mentioned. People are carrying a steady debt on their credit card. What do we know about them and their financial situation?
Oh, sure. So looking at some reports and studies that look at individuals who do carry over credit card debt, I mean, typically there are individuals who have less money, less resources to put towards that debt. So they're typically younger, lower income, lower educational levels, and also African American and Hispanic households. And those same individuals also report that, you know, they feel like they have too much debt. So they're very interested in different ways to tackle that debt, too.
So it might be people who don't have the cash flow from month to month and rely on credit card debt in part to make their basic ends meet.
Yes, absolutely. And I've never met anyone who is so excited to get that first credit card and says, yeah, I can't wait to carry over that balance. And I mean, usually people have the best of intentions. They want to build up their credit. They're just going to use it for convenience. And then, you know, something happens. Income might be up and down or big expenses. And then all of a sudden, the debt starts to snowball and grow.
And talk about credit card debt in particular. What are the interest rates like compared to the other kinds of debt we might have?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, credit card debt is starting to go up. I mean, we saw it dip a bit after the Great Recession. Maybe the average was about 12%, and now credit card debt is maybe averaging about 17%, 18%. And so you can compare that to much lower rates of interest that are being charged on maybe a federal student loan where you're looking at 5 or 6%. And then also, you know, those interest rates, whether it's for your car or for your home, that's really going to be dependent on your credit score, too. So you could get, you know, that 5 or 6% interest rate looking at a car, or you could be looking at 12% interest rate on a car.
And so for that group, we're mainly talking about here the people who are in that financial situation a little more perilous, they're likely to be paying a higher interest rate on that credit card because that's the best they can get. Am I guessing right on that?
You know, there's some behaviors that people, even if they don't pay off their credit card every month, there's some behaviors that are going to also affect your credit score. For example, if you're an individual who just pays the minimum on your credit card bill every single month, that's going to lower your credit score. But if you're an individual who maybe is rolling over a balance, but maybe you're paying twice as much as the minimum, or you're paying like a good chunk, but maybe not the whole balance, that's going to help raise your score. So it even depends how you cover or how you handle that rolling over debt.
Peggy Olive is with us from the UW School of Human Ecology, looking at credit card debt in Wisconsin and what to do about it if you have it. So, Peggy, let's dig deeper into the strategies now for someone who's out there saying, okay, yeah, that's me. I have a lot of credit card debt. I want to get it under control. I want to boost my credit rating so maybe I get better interest rates in the future. What are some of the first steps they can take to get this under control?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say a great first step is to look at your own individual spending and come up with a budget, especially if you're either interested in not putting any more debt on a credit card or if you're interested in paying off a credit card. First off, you have to know how much it costs just to meet your basic needs. And then hopefully when you have those basic needs covered, you can see how much money you can squeak out of your budget to, you know, put towards that credit card debt, to start paying that off. So even just having a good handle on, you know, how much money is coming in and going out is a great place to start.
Okay, now we've got our budget in place and we're thinking, okay, we want to find room to start hopefully paying down some of that credit card debt. How do we fit that in without, you know, giving up on those basic necessities?
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy because typically people got into credit card debt if something happened or something broke or the income's a little bit lower. So the challenge is that not only are you going to have to rein back your spending if you're used to relying on that credit, but you also have to come up with that extra money to find a way to pay off the credit card debt. So really, it's looking over your budget. Some of those expenses are going to be just set, and that's how they are, you know, the car payment, the rent, the mortgage. But then it's looking at other creative strategies that you can use for maybe it's entertainment. Maybe you're going to have a potluck with friends over instead of going out to meet them for dinner one night. So even just looking at those small ways to approach your budget and those spending habits. And nothing has to be forever. So even if you try something or have kind of a month where you've scaled back, that's going to give you a great jump start on finding that little bit of extra money.
Now, for someone who's at the start of their, I guess we could call it credit career, they want to have a credit card. They want to use it. They want to start establishing credit. They don't want to be in that situation where they've put too much on the credit card. What are some, I guess, warnings you'd give people to not let that get out of control?
Sure. So if you have just gone out and you have your first credit card, you know, congratulations for getting in there and using credit as a tool to build your credit history and get a credit score. And with every credit card, there's a limit on your spending. So your spending limit, maybe it's $500 or $1,000. And if you really want to raise your credit score and really develop your credit history, the recommendation is to not use more than 5% of the credit limit. So, you know, if you have a $1,000 credit limit, you really don't want to be charging more than, you know, a tank of gas or so during the month. If you just want to maintain your credit score, not using more than 30%, 25 to 30% of your credit limit. So many times people get their credit limit, they say, oh, you know, woohoo, I can spend $500 on my credit limit. But the closer you get to that limit, the more it's going to lower your score.
Let's talk about how many credit cards. It's not like before the Great Recession where, you know, half my mail was a credit card offer, but it's hard to go shopping at a lot of stores without them trying to get you to get their credit card. I know airlines are trying to sell credit cards to people while they're on their plane. When should we sign up for a credit card? When shouldn't we add another one?
Well, even thinking about, you know, credit as a tool and what do you need to build up your credit history, you know, thinking about if you're going to be wanting to show positive credit payments to get that car or looking at a mortgage in the future. So, you know, if you're the person that pays off your credit card in full every month, then maybe the interest rate doesn't concern you so much, and maybe you want to look for a good rewards program, you know, whether it's cash back or those flight mileage that maybe if you're flying around a lot. But if you're not sure, if you think you might be rolling over that credit card debt from month to month, then look for something with a lower interest rate. I mean, so really knowing yourself, being honest with how you're going to use it to find a card that fits best for you.
Peggy, are there resources out there for people who want to do some of the things you've been talking about, budgeting or other credit-related resources people can turn to maybe online?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, I have to put a plug in for some of the University of Wisconsin Extension resources. We have a free credit report campaign. We have a Money Matters module, and I can certainly share the website, but for people who are interested, it's at fyi.extension.wisc.edu/money. So even just Googling like extension and money, they'd find some great information about use of credit cards, credit reports, credit scores, how to get your own credit history, your credit report. So some great resources.
Big picture, what kind of trends are you watching for in the credit card world?
I do keep an eye on the credit card payment delinquencies. I mean, we know they're going up a little bit. They're nothing like they were, you know, during the Great Recession, but we know they're up a little bit. So even just keeping an eye on that. And I guess just when we talk with people, when we're working with people, just really encouraging people to have that emergency fund so that if something does happen or, you know, that next recession, that they don't have to rely on credit, that they can also have some of their own emergency savings that they can tap into.
Peggy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's Peggy Olive, Financial Capability Specialist with UW-Madison and UW-Madison's Division of Extension. We talked to her about credit card debt facing people in Wisconsin and ways to get it under control. Coming up, we'll talk about changes the Trump administration is making to the Endangered Species Act. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that the contribution of agriculture to Wisconsin's economy is growing, but the gains aren't spread evenly across the industry. We'll find out how the numbers break down in just a bit. Now, the Trump administration is planning on making some major changes to the Endangered Species Act. The Interior Department announced yesterday that it would loosen restrictions on hundreds of rare species. It argued that the 46-year-old law needs to be streamlined. Environmentalists and other critics say the changes break the law and make it easier to develop land inhabited by vulnerable wildlife. Many Republicans applauded the move, saying the species recovery process takes too long, and at least one U.S. senator is calling for further changes. Ben Lefebvre is an energy reporter at Politico. He's following this story. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the biggest changes we're seeing from the Interior Department here when it comes to enforcement of the Endangered Species Act?
One of the biggest that certainly has environmentalists upset is species that are listed as threatened, which is kind of, I guess, one step, if you want to call it better than endangered, would no longer automatically receive the same protections as endangered species do. And the reason that the groups are upset about this is because they see this as a way to keep the species from becoming endangered in the first place. So it's kind of like preventive care, I guess you could call it. So that's one change. The other is the Interior Department would regularly, designate some habitats where a species may not be, but maybe it's, you know, close to where an endangered species is living, as off limits to development, with the idea that as the species rebounds and needs to expand from where it may be into habitats where it had been, you know, traditionally, you got to keep those habitats kind of, you know, off limits to development. So that's another big change.
Another point of concern I've seen raised, Ben, is that the Interior Department would talk about the economic impact of a designation of endangered species. How would that fit into the process?
That's another big issue. They would use the compile economic analysis, which they haven't done to this point. And while Interior says it won't, you know, because it's not allowed to consider this economic analysis as it makes a decision on whether to list a species, it will make it public information somehow. They didn't say how they would do this, but the worry is that that if you start publishing this analysis, some communities may, you know, decide they'd rather have the economic, you know, if, as far as they can trust the analysis, they would rather have the economic, you know, or I guess extra revenue or development than actually protect the species that's under question.
As far as the impact of this goes, for species that are currently listed as endangered, does this change anything?
No, Interior will be grandfathering in those species. The environmentalists I've talked to are really more concerned that this will, especially the change that will not provide endangered species protection to threatened species, will just mean that the Interior Department will not be listing anymore, offering any more endangered species up for protection. They'll list everything as threatened, and therefore they actually don't have to do anything. I've noticed just in my own research that the Interior Department, since the Trump administration, I don't see that they've actually even nominated any more species as either threatened or endangered, regularly through the Fish and Wildlife Service. They've kind of stopped doing it already. And by making these changes, even if they decide to do so and make a press release that they're naming a certain species as threatened, they don't actually have to do anything to protect it.
What have been the arguments from the administration and Republican supporters in favor of these changes?
You don't hear too many. I mean, they'll say that they want to streamline the process and that this makes things more transparent. But no one I've talked to has actually been able to come up with a reason how this would help protect species per se. More of the argument from the administration is that by designating some species threatened, especially there's some, wildlife in Texas, for example, it places habitats that could be open to oil and gas development or agricultural development or home development off limits to being developed. And they think that the process for nominating these species to be listed kind of holds off too much economic development in areas where they'd like to see it.
Talking to Ben Lefebvre, energy reporter at Politico, about changes to the Endangered Species Act coming from the U.S. Department of the Interior. Ben, you mentioned some of the concerns about this, and in your piece on this, you talk about this happening in the backdrop of reports from the United Nations raising the specter of more endangered species, more plant and animal species becoming endangered in part because of climate change. What have you heard in response along those lines?
Well, that's another big worry, is that as the administration is making these changes, as you mentioned with the United Nations report, the report basically says that there are about a million species that are endangered, are likely to become endangered in the next decade or so due to climate change, changing their own habitats. And there's also, some that's becoming from human development, as they clear out more forests to build things. So that basically these changes come at the worst possible time for these species. One of the changes the Interior Department is also making is they're basically changing the language a bit. So the Fish and Wildlife Service will not be able to consider climate change as they, decide whether to list a species or not. The old rule said they could look into the foreseeable future to see, whether there's any danger to a habitat that might, endanger some species. But the new rule says basically they can only look about 20 years into the future. And some groups say that's not long enough to really take in the full scope of climate change into some of these habitats.
This is a law, the Endangered Species Act, passed by Congress, signed into law by Richard Nixon. Are there concerns, are there objections being raised that the administration is overstepping its authority, it's doing stuff outside of what the act allows the White House to do?
Yeah, we saw the California and Massachusetts attorneys general yesterday come out and say that basically this thing is going to be a target of a lawsuit as soon as it hits officially the Federal Register, which should be about another month or so. And their arguments are that these changes violate national environmental policy, and which is this next one is kind of an Achilles heel of the Trump administration's regulatory rollbacks, is that it violates the something called the Administrative Procedure Act, which is basically the rule book on how you go about changing rules in the federal government. And the criticism is that the way that the administration has laid out these changes kind of short circuits that, where they kind of didn't go through the right channels to make these changes, and therefore the changes should not be put in place.
That said, are we likely been to see lawsuits?
Oh, we're going to see lawsuits. I mean, the environmental groups have promised lawsuits. We've already had two states promise lawsuits. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey mentioned there will be other states joining the lawsuits. This is another kind of step we see with the regulatory rollbacks the administration has made, where as soon as the press releases come out, the law for the law industry's kind of wildest dreams come true. How many lawsuits get filed on these things?
Now, you wrote a report that U.S. Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming says, yeah, these changes are pretty good, but we need to go further. What are we seeing from him and other people who think, yeah, this is just a start?
This is going to be interesting how this plays out in Congress. Senator Barrasso, again, mentioned that these changes need to go further. His state is trying to keep, gas production, coal production up, and they'd like to see, I think, more rollbacks that would basically keep habitats open for more drilling. On the other hand, we're seeing other senators, including New Mexico's Senator Tom Udall, say they are looking into quashing these rule changes using a congressional response that GOP used when the Trump administration first came in to basically, allows Congress to quash any rules that came out within 60 days. So Udall's people say they can think of enough Republican senators who may be actually sympathetic to keeping the Endangered Species Act in place that they can try to get enough votes to make one of these, they're called CRA motions to kill the rule. So we'll see if we see some senators on the Barrasso side, probably energy state senators, who will try to push for more congressional tinkering with the Endangered Species Act to put in revisions they'd like to see, versus a group of senators who may just want to kill the changes altogether and keep the Endangered Species Act as is.
All that said, Ben, in our last few moments, pending those court challenges and congressional challenges, is this the law of the land now? Is this actually in effect, or does another step need to happen before that?
It is effectively the law of the land starting, I think, in about a month. They've got about, they have to put it, officially in the books, which should just take about a month or so. It's purely technical. There's nothing that can really be done now, as far as I know, that can keep this from going through. What the lawsuits may try to argue is that the changes should not be carried out until the lawsuits are finished.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Ben LaFave, energy reporter at Politico. We talked with him about the Trump administration's plans to weaken the Endangered Species Act. Among the changes, the Interior Department would publish economic impact reports when they're deciding whether to list a species. It would also loosen protections on areas where an endangered or threatened species could move into if its numbers recover, and limit protections for species that are threatened but not yet endangered. Are you left-handed? If so, today is your day. It's International Left-Handers Day, originally proclaimed back in 1976 by the group Left-Handers International. I am right-handed. Many people in my life are southpaws, including Central Time producer Tim Peterson. Hey, Tim.
Hey there, Rob.
So you're left-handed.
I am.
Okay. And has this, now you said, we were talking earlier, you grew up in a majority left-handed family.
I sure did. My father and my youngest brother, left-handed.
Okay, and are there things in your life where, despite this supportive childhood environment, I assume, where being a left-hander has frustrated you?
You know, I first noticed it in elementary school. We had to write these long reports, probably about the Piedmont region in Virginia, and I finished writing this report, pages and pages, and noticed that the whole side of my left hand covered in lead.
Right, because if you're right-handed, you keep moving away from what you just wrote, and I guess if you're left-handed, you keep moving
I've just written. Yeah, so you'd get these pages that are just marked up and smudged, and you know, that was the craft.
If this was an infomercial, we'd throw up our hands and say, "There's got to be a better way." Have you found a better way apart from just typing something?
Ink and typing.
Ink, non smearing.
That's right. I do like those reporter notebooks we have that are really narrow, that you just don't have enough room to smudge.
So your hand is always off to the side anyway.
That's right.
All right, life lessons for left-handers. Thanks, Tim. This is Central Time.
Anytime.